We here at the Battle Cry for Freedom podcast strive for civil and intelligent discussion.
We aren't always striving to reach conclusions, but to discuss important topics in a manner that allows us to explore different perspectives and consider different viewpoints.
Our goal here is to bring you those viewpoints and opinions in a way that encourages you to speak with your own voice to those around you, your friends, family, and coworkers. For those of you listening to this episode, we apologize for the audio quality and the problems that are present. These are present on the source material itself, so we are unable to correct them, but we wanted to just make sure that those of you who wanted to listen to this episode could. So please enjoy. Welcome to episode number 32 of the Battle Cry for Freedom podcast. Introducing our panelists today.
I'm Paul Unsworth.
And I'm John Epperson. And today we're going to be talking about Machiavelli and judging political leadership. Paul, would you like to introduce us to Machiavelli?
Yeah, certainly, John. So, you know, it's interesting because there's so much in our going on in our society that has never that is unique to our own particular time epoch that a lot of times nothing, you know, looking back doesn't necessarily help give us guidance on how we should move forward. But, you know, this may be refreshing or depressing, depending upon whether you're a glass half full or half empty type of person. One of the things that really has not changed since people started talking about it was it is basically how power relationships work in society at a familial, local and, you know, governmental level. People still operate under the same paradigms that have been described all the way back when Plato wrote the Republic. And I think, you know, the reason that we're going to talk about Machiavelli and not Plato is Machiavelli really is an update to the Republic. I would say that he differs from Plato because he's really the first political scientist where he isn't trying to justify, he isn't trying to, he's not trying to say something is better than it is. His entire goal is to describe politics the way politics is.
Can you?
Not the way that we want it to be. What's up?
Can you actually come back to that? Can you try recalling in? Your phone is making all sorts of crazy noises right now.
I think it's because somebody tried to call me on the call. Is it better now?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, somebody tried to call me. My mom, of course, because she always calls me at the most inconvenient time.
Isn't that what moms do?
Yeah, exactly. But it's like, okay, she doesn't call ever, and then when I'm in the middle of something, she makes a phone call. So
it's all anyway. Right. She loves you. Yes. Anyway, so you were saying something about I don't even remember what you were saying. Crap. I was trying to remember it, and then I got distracted.
That's fine. Where did it start to get? Do you remember where it started to get bad?
Start with Machiavelli's An Update to Plato.
Yeah, so Machiavelli is an update to Plato because Plato still was mythologic in terms of his explanations. And what I mean by that is Plato had an idea that there was a right answer, that there was a feel-good moral reason why a republic was the most quote-unquote just form of government. Machiavelli gets out of those esoterics and goes straight into what is the most effective method of governance, right? And so he looks at each form, you know, the republic, he looks at the princedom, he looks at all these things, and he updates all of the terms into forms that we find recognizable today. And he talks about how the strengths and weaknesses of each of those forms objectively. And what's more interesting is that, where Plato kind of has this idea that there's a pure version and a corrupted version of forms of government, Machiavelli basically says, look, the mechanisms of power are found in all forms of governments. They're just deployed slightly differently to greater or lesser effect in a way that helps that society either accomplish its objectives or not accomplish its objectives. So he moves away from the philosophical and into practical application. And so that's why, you know, Machiavelli, he was a great influence on our founders. The people of his time, especially monarchs, hated him because, you know, monarchs at this time were trying to say, oh, you know, we're divinely inspired beings. You know, we get our power, authority to rule directly from God. And the king is like most kings were nothing but brigands despoiling and oppressing their people, you know, they tried to dress it up really nicely so that they could keep their power secure. And Machiavelli's like, that's all window dressing. That's not what they're doing. This is actually what they're doing. Go ahead.
I was going to say, which is actually kind of ironic in a way, because when he wrote The Prince, right, it was actually, in a way, he was trying to get a job, right? And if I recall correctly, he didn't get it because of that book.
No, exactly, because nobody wanted the public to know that this is how these things really work. And it is one of those things. He basically wrote to Prince to say, "Hey, if
I know you're how going to be an evil tyrant, you should give me a job.
This is how, exactly. He's like, this is how you be the best evil tyrant that you can be." Right. And it's funny because, you know, one of the reasons that history has ignored discourses on Livy in favor of the prince is because of a centuries-long smear campaign on Machiavelli. I mean, it was so bad that an expression for Satan is Old Nick, right? Because it's Niccolo Machiavelli. Right, so he was equated with Satan for writing this book.
He's not well loved. Let's be fair.
Well, and the reason he's not well loved is because of how effective this propaganda campaign was against him. Right, like because Machiavelli says the prince is actually the weakest form of government because it cannot last. Right, this is something that people don't understand. And should understand. We could have an entire episode on Machiavelli, but the point that I'm getting at here is when you're trying to understand from the middle what issues that you should be concerned about, well, it's a good idea to understand that these, not only are these not old, like new issues, but the way the power works and what you can do to stop the power if it's a threat, what you need to do to protect yourselves from this type of a power, like different types of powers, not just the prince, other ones as well, and just be informed so that when, you know, legislative issues come up, you can assess and say, okay, is this something that needs a legislative fix? Is this something that should be at a federal level, at a state level, at an individual level? Because these are the mechanisms of power that are behind this legislation, if that makes sense. And I think there is no more concise, more clearly described way to do this than by talking about our old friend Machiavelli. In my opinion, he is still the best political theorist who has ever lived to this day.
So all right. So now we know who Machiavelli is, if you didn't before. Yes. And we're going to kind of talk about, as Paul has kind of hinted here, why we should give a crap about this today, because we absolutely should. Mm-hmm. Because he describes a lot of the problems that we have today, a lot of the motivations that various parties, you know, are displaying today, to help mm-hmm. us kind of understand what's going on. And we started out this week kind of, we were like, man, there's so many things happening in our government today. Like, which things should we talk about? And we ended up settling on this because we were like, well, we kind of feel like this is one of those there's nothing new under the sun type moments where we're like, well, this has all happened before. Yep. And we should just make sure that we like talk about why you should recognize it and what actual actions you can take.
And how you determine what kind of leaders you want, right? Because one of the things we were talking about in the media was John McCain, right? How, you know, before the vote, he was being villainized by the left, hero worshiped by the right. And then after the vote, it flip-flopped. Yep. So what is it? Is John McCain a good leader or a bad leader? Like, how do you look at that?
Yeah, how do you decide? Is Trump a good leader or a bad leader? How do you decide? You know, would Hillary have been... Like, we were kind of asking this question actually back during the election, but we didn't... we kind of feel like it kind of... This is a much better chance to answer it, I think.
And this is not the first time we've talked about Machiavelli. We've recommended discourses on Livy. But I think, now that we're talking about, you know, 45% of the population thinks Trump should be removed from office. Well, you know, let's talk about base. That.
He has like that 25%-ish sized base, right? That like absolutely is probably going to go down fighting with him. Like if, you know, something happens. I mean, it's definitely, we've got some interesting things going on. How do you decide who's good and bad? We were just talking about, what is it, Real News, I think? You pointed this out to me because I totally missed it. That, you know, Trump's daughter-in-law has created her own news organization in order to basically push, you know, Trump's version of the news. You know, and if you're somebody
that, propaganda, right? State-sponsored propaganda. It absolutely is.
Sure. But if you love Trump, if you think he's awesome, like obviously something has convinced you that he's awesome. And you know, how do you evaluate whether or not your conclusion is good? You know, and if you are on the flip side, how do you know for certain, with so many people thinking Trump's amazing, how do you know for certain that you made the right conclusion to dislike him? Like all of these things are things that you personally have to kind of wrestle with. And so we were like, well, we should talk about that and like why we've come to the conclusions that we have. And so you can talk about that with your friends. So.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, and I think it's really helpful at this point to point out that all of our discussion is going to be slanted in favor of a republic, since that is what we have. But it's not the only form of government. And we're not going to go talking through all of the forms of government, but it's important to understand the republic is an amalgamation of the different forms of government. So within the republic, you have the power of the prince or the dictator, right? And that manifests itself in our government through the body of the president, right? You have the element of democracy in a republic, which represents itself by popular elections. But you also have the representation of the oligarchy in the republic, which is represented by our legislative branches, right? So you have all of these different aspects with checks and balances, which is what you've heard through grade school, with the intent of maximizing the benefits of each of those types of government while minimizing their downsides. You don't eliminate their downsides. You minimize them. It's important to understand that you're never going to get rid of them. And, you know, going back to Rome, the entire purpose of the Republic is to promote stability and slow incremental change for the benefit of the most members of society, not just a few. So when you start thinking about these questions, stability versus short-term gain is a great way to encapsulize all of that. The prince, the power of the prince, according to Machiavelli, is great for getting short-term specific things done. But because of the very nature of the leader that then eliminates all threats to his power, he creates a power vacuum that destabilizes society. So it just doesn't last a long time. So when you think about, but there are times in society where there's an emergency, quick action needs to happen, and legislation isn't possible, viable, or isn't the right course. You need somebody. You need a singular vision to get you through the crisis. And that's why the Republic, Roman Republic, had the power of the dictator, right? Where all the mechanisms of government were consolidated into one person's hands for a limited period of time to get them through a crisis. This was something they actually built in to it. And they called it the dictator, which is a word that has survived to this day, but actually means it's very negative. But to be fair, it was that power of the dictator that would become corrupted over time, that would allow Julius Caesar to destroy the Republic. So it is a dangerous power, a necessary but dangerous power. And so in our version 2.0 of the Roman Republic, we created the executive branch with checks against his power to prevent that from happening. But we have had some... So again, we talked about state-sponsored propaganda with Trump, and we're starting to talk about Trump. We have in the past mentioned him in totalitarian language. I've said this stems from the fact that he's a CEO and that a lot of times CEOs are nothing but mini tyrants. But I think it's important to understand that that skill set isn't necessarily bad for the presidency. And in fact, some of our greatest presidents have needed to use that power to get us through crises,
And not just our friend.
What?
King Andrew. King Andrew is not the only one.
Okay. Yes, King Andrew's not the only one. I mean, Lincoln, right? Yep. Suspended the power of habeas corpus, right? Like, he basically said, guess what? Timely trial's not happening in the Civil War, right? Teddy Roosevelt expanded the power of the government to create the national park system, to bust trusts, to start and end wars on his own discretion, to create an American empire, FDR, in order to get us through the Great Depression. I mean, the executive power, like some of the people who we say are the greatest presidents of all time, have also been the closest thing to despots that we've had.
Yeah, I think our probably only exception to that, right, is Washington, which I think we were Cincinnati's. Very lucky in. I think we were awesomely lucky to have Washington, because he not only, wasn't a despot, but he also managed to give us this great, peaceful transition of power for our first transition, which has, I think, set us off on the right foot as a nation forever after. Mm-hmm. The point is that, like, He's probably the only one among our quote-unquote great presidents, right, that wasn't a quote-unquote tyrant of sorts, right, that we couldn't make the argument for, I think, at least. I think it's important to note that we actually do have a tendency to have some admiration for these guys.
So you can't say Trump is just a bad leader because he... exerts the power of the executive, or he tends towards despotism, because that's kind of what the job
is.
Needs. Yes. Yes. Yeah, it's kind of what the job is.
If you're going to make the argument that he's a bad president, you need some sort of other metric, right? Which is kind of what we wanted to talk about. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't have a cut and dry, amazing metric for this. But
I think that comes with the price of the Republic, right? Which is civic virtue. I think maybe we in the middle are more comfortable with this, but it really depends upon the situation. There isn't going to be a black or white metric for it all the time. It's going to take education and discernment to know who's the right leader for the right time.
Yeah.
and involvement. So the trifecta: education, discernment, and involvement, to ensure that we have the right leaders in place to get us through the things that impact us all across society.
Yeah, which is absolutely a thing that I think there are many, many poor accusations that are made against people, but I think the one accusation that is valid is if you aren't involved, like, it becomes terribly difficult to justify your position, you know, if you aren't finding the time involved. At the same time, we also have to note the difficulty that people are finding because of their situations due to their jobs or things like this. And it's absolutely important that we protect people against disenfranchisement too. So
absolutely. Well, and we can talk about, we'll talk about that a little bit. I think we should elaborate on how you have to understand that the powers of the oligarchy and the powers of the prince are going to attempt to disenfranchise as many people as possible because it's easier for them to maintain power.
Right. And that's their nature.
That's in their very nature. Yeah. The nature of the, which is what you read Machiavelli, you know it, and it makes sense. You say, oh, that's why they want to make it harder for people to vote. Oh, that's why they want a gerrymander, because they're exercising the power of that type of political structure.
Well, they're exercising their gift, right? It is what makes them, it's what makes them the prince. It's what gives them, it's what makes the prince effective.
It's what makes them a senator. Yeah, and it's what makes them a senator, right? Like, it's what the job requires. And I will say this, honestly, aside from voter participation, the other most disturbing trend that I see is the alignment of Congress and the presidency, right? Like, those are supposed to be two forces that fight each other. So with this whole idea that the president is also the head of his party and de facto collusion between the legislative and the executive branch, and this isn't just with this presidency, though I think it's kind of coming to a head here, because even Republicans, people who vote Republicans, are saying, what happened to my party? Like, what are happening to all these values that we supposedly had that apparently are just getting ignored in favor of party unity? And you get, on the other hand, people saying, well, we are supposedly have control of all three branches of government. Why aren't we getting more things done? Right? Like, I think it's important to understand the object of a republic is to make sure that as little gets done as possible, because when things are getting done rapidly and fast, chances are liberty is being eroded in the process.
Yeah.
And people's freedoms are being taken away.
And we have absolutely discussed this before, that it's dangerous to have things move quickly. Yes. There are blockers on purpose. Like, it's not an accident. And that was the intention of the original founders.
Mm-hmm.
Which is,
I mean, the fact that Mike Pence, so I mean, again, it always comes back to this for me, the fact that the vice president and the president are on a single ticket is one of the most glaring problems, like, because they had to make an amendment to go that way. I mean, I've said this before, originally the vice president was supposed to be the person with the second most votes, right? So the executive, the president, couldn't use the vice president to break ties in the legislature, because chances are he was the person he was campaigning against the entire time, yep. Right? The vice president wasn't supposed to help the president. He was supposed to check the president. And that was one of the first things that happened that removed a check against the president. The expansion of executive privilege has really been another one, but that one has become worse and worse over time. But that vice president, removing the vice president as an effective check against the president, is something that I feel like we really need back, right? I think this would be a very different country if Hillary Clinton were vice president, or if John McCain had been vice president, or if John Kerry had been vice president, right? Like Mitt Romney had been vice president. Imagine how differently things would look at this point in history.
Absolutely. It's super interesting, actually. So this is probably the best. I'm gonna let that go. So I had something else, but I was like, oh, I'm just distracting us. So one of the things that we're talking about is, so we're talking about the prince, right? The particular form of government espoused by the prince, which our president is intended to be.
Yes.
And then we've discussed the fact that as a republic, one of the things that a republic is intended to do specifically is protect us against the incursions of the prince, right? By providing all of these checks and balances. And the way that works.
Well, and it should be, and it should be noted, if they aren't formed in a republic, the princes and the oligarchs end up fighting each other for power all the time, and the people suffer. So oligarchs, maybe I should use the word princes, and, or I should use nobility instead of oligarchs.
Yeah, that's probably good.
Right? Think about European history. It is one continuous tale of the struggle of power between kings and nobles. And the peasants suffer, right? I mean, would you say that's fair, John?
That's absolutely fair. I mean, we've talked about it before. The poor suffer, right, the most during war. But it's rarely their war.
Yeah.
It's almost always a power struggle of some kind.
So the Republic is designed to make that fighting happen in a contained environment, right? Legislative houses as opposed to battlefields. Think about that. That's I think that's John, am I wrong? Like, I think that's a super important point.
That's exactly what it is, and that's exactly what, I mean, we've espoused it here on the show multiple times. This is exactly what we think. Is anything between the both of us. I mean, you're right. This is, the Republic creates an arena, right, of sorts, to kind of contain that. So the thing that I was actually kind of trying to get at is, I think there's a lot of confusion sometimes. We've talked about this on our show. There's a lot of confusion. People are like, oh, we're a democracy. But that's actually not true. We're not a democracy. Yep. A democracy is where the majority rules everything all the time. Everybody votes on everything.
Yep.
We make all decisions based on what the majority wants. There's no check on the power of the majority, right? A republic is intended to protect specifically the rights of the minorities, because the majority are going to get their way most of the time. All of the checks and balances and everything are intended to make sure that the minorities have some say while not giving them the power to rule everything, which is why you have the power of the dictator, the prince, right? Baked into the presidency, because the prince can represent a minority, in which Paul and I have argued many times that currently our government represents the minority, the rich, right now. And so the presidency can represent the interests of the minority, but all of the checks are purposefully there and put into place to protect, to make sure that they can't do too much. So it's a balanced thing, and we're not saying that it's like perfectly balanced, because let's be fair, I think we both think that stuff is totally out of whack right now, but this idea is that the Republic provides some sort of balance, a little bit of fairness, right, a little bit of equality in order to get things done. And put your point in and then we'll move on.
No, go ahead, because it's going to follow up this point really well.
When you're judging leaders, the point is that you have to make your judgments while keeping all of this context in mind. So we spent like the first half of this episode trying to give you context, because part of the thing that we want to do is also provide a little bit of a framework for how you can judge leaders. And as we've mentioned at least a couple times so far in this broadcast, people are saying, well, Trump's a bad president because he's tyrannical. And our point is, you can think he's a bad president, but that's a terrible reason for thinking he's a bad president, because he's not the first tyrannical president, and he's not going to be the last tyrannical president. And in fact, the presidency was intended to give outlet to tyranny so that basically things can get done that need to get done.
So just to be clear there, I would say that he's not the manifest. He's like, what? So tyranny is a dictator that's unchecked.
So I'm probably using a bad term. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, so I would say that it's the power of the dictator, the power of the prince, the president is given. It's a limited and checked authority for someone to be able to have that kind of power in a way that's not going to allow one individual's self-interest to then be advanced at the cost of the rest of society, right? It's kind of a tyrant with training wheels in some ways, like that's a little bit of what we're talking about. But I wanted to bring up John McCain because he is incredibly relevant right now because of his healthcare vote. And I'm not going to get into to whether it was good or bad or what I think about it, but I think it's very interesting. The reason I would say he's a good leader is the reasons he gave, right? So when he gave his vote, he gave a huge talk about how the alignment, echoing what I said earlier, I was echoing him when he talked about the alignment between the legislative and executive branch is a problem. And his whole rationale, I guess, could be boiled down to, I'm voting no so that we can hit the reset button and go back and make this thing the way that it's supposed to happen through committees and legislation and bipartisan cooperation to come up with a better, more balanced approach.
Well, the other things that he's said recently include things like, well, the biggest problem that I see is that when the Democrats tried to push this through, they rushed it through and cut the Republicans out of the process. And he's like, I don't want to do the same thing again with the other party, right? He's like, because that's just going to end up in terrible legislation again, right? And it's, I guess, I think what you're trying to get at, Paul, is it's not his choice so much as his respect for the institution, his attempt to preserve the institutions that we have as a country. That's what we respect about him, and that's what makes him good or bad. So I think that's probably, honestly, our first our first metric, right, for good leadership is like,
do they respect the process? Do you respect the process, right? Like, I think that is so important in a republic, because the institutions are there to protect everybody. And while it may seem tempting to bypass them and to just, change the rules to make it more convenient. I mean, it's funny because the Democrats have always changed rules in response to not getting their way when they had political power. And then they ended up getting screwed by it. it's an amazing thing.
We just had a great example of this recently when they basically changed the rules in the Senate, right? For, I think it was for confirmations, right? That they changed it from
the Supreme Court. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. They changed.
They made it so you can't filibuster. Yeah.
Yeah. So now you can't. Which is so stupid because it just bit them in the butt. And now we have a Supreme Court justice that they couldn't filibuster, right?
Yep. Somebody who is highly quite, I mean, he's another, in my opinion, he'll be another Clarence Thomas, but that's neither here nor there. I think that, this is why, you have these things there, so that essentially you put nominees that aren't agents of a party forward, because otherwise they're not going to get confirmed, and now that check is gone.
Yep.
Right, and that's bad. Right. The less twists and turns, and that's essentially what John McCain was saying. Right. He's like, we cannot continue down this pathway. And let's be fair. I mean, how many Republicans feel like Donald Trump is representing their cause right now. Yes, there's a portion of them, 28 to 32%. But 70% of them, now it's, I'm not saying the Democrats are doing a better job here, but my point is, I mean, I've had so many of my friends go from R to I. They're joining us, John, in the eyes.
Over well, the fact we've discussed that before, like, we think eyes are the biggest group anyway.
They are. I would agree with that. Yeah. But my point is, you know, they're not representing. And John McCain is saying this. Look, we're forcing this stuff through because of the vocal minority in our party that's super active and super mobilized, but we're not representing, we're not respecting the process, and we're not actually representing what we've been sent here to do by the majority. And let's be clear, House of Representative people are a little bit different because their districts are highly what's the opposite of homogenized?
Gerrymandered?
They're very, like, people in communities tend to be a certain way. Like, when you look at a state, in order to win a state.
So I think homogenized was the right term.
Is homogenized the right term? Okay.
It means the same.
Or fairly homogenized.
They're very similar.
Yes, they're very similar. But when you look at a senator cannot win unless he has some of the votes from the people who aren't naturally aligned with his party.
Right? He has because a heterogeneous population.
Yes, because he has to have urbans and rurals vote for them in order to get elected. So senators tend by their very nature to be more moderate, right? And that was McCain's point. And I mean, when you have 29 Republican governors saying, this is a terrible idea, you cannot do this, right? And yet you only had three Republican senators voting no. That tells you that those senators were voting against the interest of their state in favor of interest of their party, which means they're not representing the people who voted them to get there.
Or it certainly calls it into question, right?
Yes, yes. And this is not unusual. I mean, Machiavelli will say that when the people are out of control, the oligarchs, the Senate, he'll call them, and the prince will team up to subjugate them. Right?
Yep.
Even though their natural state is at war, when both of them feel like the power of their institutions are threatened, they will align to subjugate the people.
Because the number one thing they always have in common is they all want to stay in power, right? Power you tend to want to stay in power when you're in power. Right? We can talk about that endlessly, but the point is they have that in common, and so whenever one of them feels it, almost all of them will feel it too. So that's exactly what's going on right now. Is there's a lot of pain in America, right? We saw it in the last election. Yeah. Every pundit ever is talking about how Americans are angry. Like, we're not the only ones talking about that. And yet we're forgetting that, like, okay, so everyone in America is angry. You know, we ended up with Trump and people were still angry. So people want things to change, and we've given the signals that we're angry. So now those who are in power are trying to figure out how they can remain in power, right, through this anger. And this is them doing that, you know. Let's get together. Let's all ally on things, you know. And this has been slowly happening for a number of years. This didn't happen overnight with Trump at all.
No. I would say realistically, probably since Reagan, this has been slowly building up. I think Nixon was the beginning of the cracks. Maybe Lyndon Johnson. I mean, I would say that this is definitely mid-20th century.
Starts, right? Because it starts really small.
Well, I mean, I think that the allegiance of FDR with the kind of lame duck Truman into the superhero Ike, like, I think that, like, after Ike, the crap, you know, because people just trusted the government after FDR, like, during and after FDR.
True.
I think that trust began to erode probably with Vietnam, you know, with Kennedy and then Lyndon Johnson. And I think Nixon really, really put a dent in it. And then ever since Nixon, it's just been downward spiral for the trust in our institutions. And I will say largely, like, so we talked about respect for institutions, respect for the rule of law. Like, realistically, leaders limiting themselves for the good of society, like, it's kind of been one of those things that we just expect. And because we know that there's corruption and we know that they're going to abuse those powers, but, you know, they're supposed to do it in moderation, right? You know, so that they don't have to fear the wrath of the voters. Like it's the stick isn't the only reason that we want those leaders to be to restrain themselves, right?
Yeah, and we don't want to just be punishing them. We want them to do it of their own volition. Right. Want to reward them
because they love the country, because they respect the institutions, because they think that America is great already the way it is, which kind of segues into Trump. Like, if you know, what are the metrics that we judge a president, right? And I'm going to start with Lincoln here just for a second, because Lincoln, strangely enough, I would say that Jefferson Davis actually expanded the power of the executive way more than Lincoln did. I mean, he instituted a draft. He did all kinds of things that, you know, they were losing a war, so they were pretty desperate. But you can't act like Lincoln was a choir boy, right? I mean, he rammed a lot of things through and expanded the executive power a lot. But his entire goal was to preserve the Union, right? Like, that was his thing, to save the country. And I think that's one of the reasons he gets a pass for all of that, was his goal was to save the country. Same thing with Teddy Roosevelt, right? Teddy Roosevelt was sitting there like, you know, America is the greatest country on earth. The rest of the world should acknowledge that. He made Americans feel good about being Americans at a time when Europe looked at us as hayseeds and podunks. Right. And so that first strand of America is not just great in America, being American is better than everybody else in the world, really comes from TR. And so that shot of nationalism, I think, are why people love him, why he's on the Washington Monument. And when you look at FDR, I mean, the greatest financial crisis in our history, he was at the helm telling people it was going to be okay. He was that soft, calm voice that basically said, we can persevere and we can get through this. Even though he's the first one who stacked the courts, even though he expanded all these government programs. I mean, he's the granddaddy of federal spending, yet we love him because of that, right? So then we get to Trump. Like, the problem that I think Trump has is he's not stepping into an America in crisis. Not, it's an existential crisis, but it's not a civil war. It's not a transition into a modern society. It's not in the midst of a Great Depression, which the country was already in depression when FDR became president. It had gone through two presidents, Coleridge and Herbert Hoover. Yeah,
we have the internet. Hoover was the one who got blamed for it.
I did not need the internet. I actually knew that. So,
well, I was trying to. I'm pretty sure that the Depression started with Hoover. That's why I'm looking it up.
It did. It did. But what I'm trying to say is that, like, FDR was the third president to deal with the Great Depression, right? Like, he wasn't.
So
my point is, he came into a crisis. This is what I'm saying.
So Hoover started the Depression, and yes. FDR came immediately after.
So I thought Coolidge came before.
Coolidge came before Hoover.
Yeah, but it starts with Coolidge was president when the Great Depression starts.
I was pretty sure it was Hoover. Hang on, look, I'm looking this up.
Hoover didn't fix it. Yeah, Hoover didn't fix it. So Coolidge, then Hoover, right? So he was the third president to deal with the Great Depression. Almost positive.
Great Depression start. Okay, technically, the very last year that Coolidge was president and the very first year that Hoover was president. So hang on.
So my statement was that he was the third president to deal with the Great Depression.
October of 1929. So I guess technically it would have been that would have been Hoover. Hoover would have been the president.
But Coolidge was in office when it happened.
Right before it happened. Hoover was in office.
But Coleridge was still in office when it happened.
No. It happened in 1929 in October of 1929. So Hoover would have been president at this point.
He wouldn't have been president because the election doesn't happen until November, right?
No, he was president. The election happened in November of 28. And Coolidge was president for a few days in January of 1929. And then Hoover takes over.
Oh, man. So he was president until March of 1929.
I thought it was in January, but that's okay. Still, March of 1929. Hoover was president at this point.
Hold on. So the Great Depression starts in October of 1929.
So two presidents. Okay. So what? Not trying to rip on you.
Wait a second.
Look. Okay. So
Hold on.
I'm not trying to rip on you. I just don't want to be giving people bad facts. That's what the internet's for.
No, I agree with that, but hold on. Let's see.
We're going to spend the last 10 minutes of the show just
we're going to be talking about the Great Depression because, like, I was certain that that Coleridge.
Yeah.
Oh, hey, there we go. All right. Well, no, I guess I don't know why I always read that Coleridge was part of this, but I guess he wasn't. I guess it was because he was president until March of the year that it started, because he left in March, and it ended and it started in September of that year.
Yep. So. Either
so I
way,
guess he was
two
the
presidents.
President
two presidents.
Yes, two presidents to deal with it. Because I thought, you know, Coleridge was against expanding aid. But I guess that just wasn't.
So, wasn't I mean, the important thing to note here is not any of the other stuff, but the fact that, you know, basically, because it doesn't really matter about Hoover and Coolidge. The thing that matters is that people were upset at what they did, and that, you know, FDR came in and people saw it as a good thing. That is really the important thing that we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm. So So these people that are well-loved were in the middle of crises, and Trump actually doesn't have a crisis that is not existential. Yep. I mean, he's sort of inheriting Afghanistan and Iraq. The world is in more crisis than, I think, probably since the collapse of the Soviet Union, at least. And I would say that, but domestically, you know, we're still booming after the Great Recession. Like, job people, you know, there are more people employed, although their standard of living is lower. More people have jobs. Like, this idea, then he doesn't have as much room to move as a prince and still necessarily be liked. And I think whether it is the nepotism that has been displayed, whether it is the uncomfortable relationship of his business ventures with some of the policies that are outlined, his relationship with Russia, like, it has seemed more self-interested, which is why if you're going, and I think if you're going to judge a president, whether or not the interests, what he's doing is in the interest of the country or in the interest of himself, is probably the baseline metric of that. And I think perhaps more troubling is the lack of respect for the institutions, like, you know, his clear disregard for the media, his complaints about being restricted by the Justice Department, his complaints about having to go through Congress. I mean, these are all troubling things to hear from somebody who those institutions exist solely to restrain the natural, proclivities of that office, right?
Yep. Yeah. Okay. So that all kind of falls under that one test that we discussed, right? Respect for the process, mm-hmm. respect for the institutions. So I guess another thing that I think that is important when you're evaluating a leader that I've always considered is their ability to bring people that disagree with them along with them. And the reasoning for that is because we live in a diverse society. We live in, you know, this pluralist where there are many viewpoints, right? Society that you cannot have consensus no matter what you do. So the good leaders of our world, right, are remembered for the fact that they convinced people that were on the other side to follow them. Now, I would venture to say that there are definitely cases where you could make arguments to the contrary, right? Like, I think, for example, this is one of the tests, right, for good leadership that I think Lincoln is the weakest on, right? And I'm not necessarily sure it's his fault, but I think he's weak here, but I don't think he fails. And the reason why is because I think the Union got behind Lincoln, and there were definitely people that were in the North of the United States at the time that were not cool with Lincoln. But he did manage to get the Union behind him. The reason why he's weak is because the country split under him. I mean, the reason why the South broke away at the time was because their candidate didn't win and Lincoln won, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, we look back and we say, okay, well, you guys, you know, you created this, you know, well, do what we say or else scenario, right? I mean, Lincoln kind of is a little weak on this, you know, but look at FDR, for example, right? Look at Churchill. Look at many of the great leaders that we respect in the world. And the thing that they have going for them is because the people who opposed them said, okay, I'll accept you for now because you're pushing for my interests too. We have mutual benefit, right?
Well, even look at someone like Otto von Bismarck, right? Like, Bismarck was famous for that.
Yeah.
I mean, and he was basically a straight up, well, I mean, technically there was a king in Germany, but Otto von Bismarck basically.
He's the one that made it happen show for 30, in the first place.
Yeah, for 30 years. I mean, he kept peace in Europe for 30 years, pretty much unilaterally.
Yep. So, trying to come up with things that make good leaders, like these are characteristics, right, that you want. Do you want somebody who can get buy-in from the opposition? And I think that's one thing that this is probably my biggest criticism of our current leadership, is that there's no attempt to get buy-in from opposition. If you aren't if you aren't currently believing in Trump today, then you're the enemy and you're stupid. And then he lies and tells his constituents, oh yeah, they're all with me, you know. And it's very clear that he has opposition, you know. So this would be my current biggest criticism against him, is I think that Trump flat out.
Well, and then the fact is that if he doesn't get his way, it's because it was rigged. It was because there's false voters. It's not because his position didn't have merit. Let's be clear.
So, I think this is important.
But I think, hold on, before we get here, one of the reasons that Caesar was able to come to power is he made a deal with the two other most powerful men in Rome, Caesar, that was the second triumvirate. Pompey, Caesar, and Cassius? Is it Cassius? No, it's Crassus. Sorry, Crassus. Yes. So
I'm just looking it up so that we're correct.
Yes.
Crassus. Marcus Linnaeus.
Yes.
Cinnaeus Crassus.
Crassus, yes. So So, by the way, the reason that Coleridge gets mentioned is because when the stock market spiked, it was under the last year of his presidency. Was when
sure.
That,
I'm not saying he doesn't have anything to do with it. I'm just saying that
no. But that's why
fixing the problem.
But that's why, in my mind, Coleridge is always associated with it, is because of that. But the Depression didn't happen on his watch, so that was. But I'm just saying that's why
we do this all the time. It's very difficult to decide which leader we should blame for things. And people love to blame all the bad things on the previous leader and take credit for all the good things on themselves, right? That's normal.
Yeah, it's just like a lot of the stuff that helped the Great Recession that we just had came in the last 3 months of George Bush's time in office, which Obama then took credit for. And a lot of the things that have led to the job growth in the last 6 months are the result of things that Obama did that Trump is now claiming credit for. Sure. And the things that Obama did that didn't work out, Trump is blaming Obama for. And the things that Bush did that didn't work out, Obama blamed him for. Right? Like this. But back to the point that we're trying to get is, so Pompey controlled the Senate, Crassus controlled the banks, and Caesar controlled the army. And so essentially what they did was they divided where all those forces had previously fought each other. They unified them in such a way that there was nothing to stop them, and they just made all the rules. So this idea of, you know, opposition is bad. Well, opposition is only bad if you want to be a tyrant. If you care about an egalitarian society, opposition is fantastic, because it makes sure that nobody gets out of control.
Yep. So getting buy-in from the opposition isn't the same as creating an alliance with opposition. Buy-in is getting them to work with you despite maintaining that they still have differences with you, right? It's when we have bipartisan legislation, you know, for example, this is one case where it can happen. That's getting buy-in from the opposition, because they still remain Democrats and Republicans, right? Getting an alliance is something different totally. So this is kind of where I think we kind of almost bled into my third test. Talk about transparency a lot. Okay, so all right.
Okay,
so the third test, the third test is I think a little bit more difficult to suss out, but this one has to do with honesty, about lying, about trust, right? So this is the dictator portion. So the leadership has
down.
A tendency
trust.
To be to kind of. Leadership can fall into this dictatorial standpoint, right? So the third leg of leadership is, how much do you trust this person? And I think this kind of feeds all the other things. But, you know, we've had a lot of talk in the past few years of transparency. We want transparency from businesses. We want transparency from our government. And really, at the end of the day, what we want is to be able to trust our government. We want to know when they're lying and when they're not lying, right? We want to know what they're doing behind the scenes. We want to know, be able to trust that they're doing things for our best interests. And the fact that we want this transparency, I think, betrays the fact that we do not trust our leaders currently. And I think one of the things, I'm glad that we bring up John McCain, because John McCain's a great example of a person that you don't necessarily trust that he's always going to do what you want. But I think that John McCain is one of those people that you trust to have your interests at heart. I think Bernie Sanders is another good example. I think that's exactly why Bernie had the following that he did. It has nothing to do with his policies and everything to do with the fact that people were like, this guy will take care of me, right? And that's what people wanted.
Well, I mean, when you look at his voting record, right? The fact that, I mean, this is what it meant for me. Like, regardless of whether I agreed with him on specifics, the fact that he voted what I considered the right way on every topic that I think hurt America over the last like 20 years made me say, yeah, he has good judgment, right? He's been consistently against things like the 97 crime bill, against NAFTA, against the Iraq war, like all of these places where I'm like, man, that just sucked for America. Bernie Sanders is one of the only voices saying no.
Yeah.
And you trust him.
Yeah. You don't have to agree with a person to trust them. And
well, I think that was one of the problems that Hillary Clinton had, was that she was so means justifies the ends, getting back to something that Machiavelli had.
The ends justify the means.
Sorry, yes. That works for an executive, kind of. But for an oligarch, it doesn't really work. And I think that, you know, Hillary Clinton coming from a, trying to make that transition from an oligarch to a prince, that's where she stumbled, right? Because the prince is supposed to personify a view or opinion or an ideal, right? That society says, you know, we're having trouble dealing with this on an individual level. Lead us through this troubled times. And when somebody favors expediency over a long career, because that's the nature of legislation, it can undermine that need, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So I feel pretty good that we've actually kind of hit upon the things that we care about in leadership. Was there anything that you felt like we missed, Paul?
Well, I guess, you know, just to sum up, like, I think that ultimately Machiavelli says the shelf life of a republic depends upon how long the citizens remain interested in maintaining the republic and don't get distracted by their own affairs. I mean, he calls that virtue, public virtue, in his works. But honestly, I think that it all comes down to, you can't be a backseat driver when you're evaluating these leaders. I think that you don't have to come up with the litmus tests by yourself. I mean, honestly, John, we didn't say anything about these guys, like what makes a good leader, other than, you know, that Machiavelli doesn't say. Like, it's interesting. Machiavelli says it's better to be feared than loved if you're a prince, right? But he does not say that for a republic, right? Like, you know, and I think one of the interesting things is Caesar may have been a dictator, or you could argue a tyrant, but he had the love of the people behind him, because the Senate had alienated itself from the needs of the people. I would argue in a way that's kind of happening right now. So I guess at the end of the day, instead of being issue driven by things that cannot be solved by politics, I think what we need to be as voters is institution driven.
Leadership
is someone first and foremost.
Are they good leaders?
That's where I'm getting, right? No, it's institution driven, because then we elect leaders that are going to do the best for those institutions, right? So we elect someone for president who, I mean, what was Abraham Lincoln's tagline? Honest Abe, right? Honest Abe. People knew that he never lied. That was his thing, right? Teddy Roosevelt was, you know, the rough rider. I mean, he started a war and then then resigned his commission so that he could raise a volunteer infantry to go fight in the war, right? He was the rough rider. He was going to let his actions talk, right? Like, that's why people love Teddy Roosevelt. Washington was that way. That is so what I'm saying is, I guess first and foremost, you can't let the lesser of two evils be your choice for who you elect to the most important thing in the land. I would say the first and foremost is, if you abdicate your choice to someone, are they going to make decisions that you respect? So do you respect that person first and foremost as a person? And I will say here, since becoming a father, how someone is in his role as father plays a great part in how I judge their qualifications for leadership.
Well, I think
because
it's a...
if someone can't be a good leader in their family, I sure as hell don't think they can be a good family, a good leader for the country.
Yep.
Right? Like that is absolutely a thing. And say what you want about Obama, say what you want about Bush, they're great dads. Therefore, they can only be so bad. Right? Like that's the baseline for me personally. So when I go to the voting booth, I say, how's this person as a dad? Because that's a baseline. Right. And that's how I establish it. But I think that you need to start there, because here's what I want. I don't need somebody in office who's going to agree with me on every single issue. I need someone in office who's going to at least consider some of the things that I face every day when they make decisions, and then decide that despite all of that, this is still the best way forward for the majority of our country. Right. Like, but someone who at least understands where I'm coming from.
So
they don't have to agree with me. They have to understand me, I guess. Right? Like that's different.
So something that we should point out is that not all leaders that are going to be on the ballot are going to be dads. Some of them are
going
to be moms.
Sure. I'm just saying,
or
just
not
saying,
at all.
Just an example.
Not a parent at all.
Yeah. Right. And I'm just saying that's since everybody, well, okay, I'll put it towards Hillary, right? Like the fact that Hillary made her family work puts a low, and John and I have had this discussion before.
Yep.
I constantly say
that's one of the good points for her,
I do not understand why she gets thrown under the bus as much as she does from the family values folk, because forgiving her husband and keeping her family together and making it work,
that shows commitment. That shows how much work, dedication. Like these are important things, you know. And we give Hillary grief all the time on this show because we have problems with her. But that's not one of them. That's one thing that we respect.
And I will say this: you cannot say that she doesn't have values, because she absolutely has family values.
Yep. And I think one of the things that we try to do here is we try to be fair about this, right? Like we tell you what we think, because for the most part, we know what we think on a lot of things, right? We tell you guys what we think, and we tell each other what we think because, well, we're like, okay, so Hillary has good family values in our opinion, you know? So that's a tick mark in the good box for us, right? But we don't like some of her other leadership qualities, right? And, you know, so that bothered us during the past election or whatever. You know, Trump has, you know, certain things going for him. Let's be fair, I have a difficult time thinking of those, but some people believe he has some good things going for him. You know, he totally fails in the honesty box. Actually, Hillary did too, let's be fair, for me.
Yeah.
And that makes it tough for me to like them as leaders. You know, Bernie had that going for him. The honesty box, totally checked. You know, the visionary
and he also
part,
had the discernment,
totally checked.
And he had the discernment box checked. Maybe the discernment and visionary are the same kind.
Sure.
Box.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways, being visionary is having that discernment, is having the ability to say, oh, this idea, even though I don't like it or somebody else doesn't like it, actually, that's a good way forward for us, right?
And he has the trust of his constituents, right? He dominates as an independent in Massachusetts, right? Like,
no, Vermont.
His people.
But that's
Vermont, a... sorry, Vermont. Yeah. Well, one of those East Coast.
Yeah, one of those East Coast states.
But,
wow.
But the point is that he has the trust of his constituents, right?
Yes.
Like,
and even during the election, he was getting buy-in from people that were not Democrats. You know, he was getting buy-in. Most of his buy-in was from independents, to be fair, right?
Yep.
But he brought people from the Republican side as well.
Every state where they allowed independents to caucus with whatever party they wanted, he dominated. Every single one. In Washington, 78% went for Bernie. Like, he crushed Hillary here. Crushed her. Absolutely crushed her. Because Washington has more independents than most states.
Yeah, I mean, this is why
we're like
a good leader.
We like our guns and the environment. Washington. We drive our electric cars with our rifle racks.
That's the reason why you guys aren't Democrats, is because they won't let you have guns.
Exactly.
The point is that leadership is a difficult thing, and trying to evaluate leadership, I think, is a very difficult thing. But these, I think, we're trying to elucidate some of the reasons why we think leadership is how you can evaluate leadership. And to us, having good leadership is important because lukewarm, I'm better than the other guy leadership is not okay. That doesn't get you anywhere. No. In fact, that's a bit of a trap, we think, in a lot of ways. I forgot that we were going to make this point too. The lukewarm leadership is almost as bad. In fact, I think in many ways, it's just as bad as the obvious evil leadership. Lukewarm leadership erodes
your institutions. Yeah, it's dangerous to the vitality. Yes, that's exactly right. It leads to the inevitable tyranny and destruction of the republic, right?
Yeah, the bad because leader requires lukewarm leadership to prepare the way for him, right? Or her,
yes.
Right? Like, bad leadership can't work without leadership first. And the only way to correct that is to say, okay, we're going to stop voting for the lesser of two evils, right? Or lesser two weevils, if we master and commander it. You're gonna vote. we're gonna vote for the person of conscience. We're gonna vote for the good leader. And I think it's important. If you're gonna do that, you have to recognize what the good leader is, and you have to not be afraid. You have to trust that your fellow citizens are gonna do that too. And I think you have to build up that trust. It's a thing that has to happen. Yep.
Exactly. So anyway, Machiavelli. You know, as I said, can give I hope we demonstrate. I mean, all this you can pretty much find in discourses in Livy. But stay committed. Don't let people who you think aren't good people be your leaders, because you're going to get exactly what you think you're going to get. And if you wonder what it takes to make America great again, then vote for people with character, even if you don't agree with them on every issue, like John McCain.
Vote for John McCain. That's right.
You know, I as I've said before in this podcast, if it hadn't been for Sarah Palin, I totally would have voted for him.
That's fair. All right, should we move on?
It's nothing against it's nothing against Obama. It was more that I felt like with two wars, someone with military experience is what this country needs.
I've never had a bad opinion of John McCain, ever.
Yeah.
It's grown over time, but I've never had a negative opinion of him.
And I think that's the other problem, is when he campaigned, he stopped being John McCain during the campaign. I think that was part of the problem. He had to try to get hit because he knew his base hated him. So, yeah, he had to go back to his base, but I think he should have just had faith that he would have pulled moderate Republicans or moderate Democrats and independents if he had been John McCain, and he would have won the election that way. They had to give up Sarah Palin. That just doesn't make any sense. I thought if he had picked Joe Lieberman as his running mate, he would have been president of the United States, I think. All right, two picks. Do you want to go first? Because, you know, I have my legion of picks.
So the first is probably an obvious one. You should read Prince and Discourses on Livy if you're even sort of kind of interested in this kind of stuff. So the thing that you should know is that despite the name Prince, right, Machiavelli, and despite his reputation, Machiavelli is actually arguing that the Republic is much better than authoritarianism. Point of writing The Prince is to expose how the Prince works. And so if you're at all interested and want to know like what to look for, what to avoid, like read The Prince. He tells you exactly how it works. How the machine works
in a way better than I would argue anyone before or after has ever done. I mean, it's clear, concise.
I recommended a book on this podcast a while ago. what is it, The Dictator's Handbook, Why Bad Behavior is Almost Always Good Politics or whatever. That's a good book. Machiavelli writes it in a different way. And I think they both have things to tell you, but I would argue, along with Paul, that Machiavelli is better. So that's kind of a gimme or whatever, but you should definitely read that. So I was actually doing some work with some people this week. So I have a local, I helped to start this local meetup for junior developers, and it's kind of grown even bigger, you know, than I originally intended, you know, which is cool. We're totally happy and we think it's awesome, you know, and we think it's great for Charlotte. But so one of the things that, like, I'm getting a lot more questions about, well, how do I learn this, or how do I find out about this? And so we were doing some digging, and I've known about Khan Academy for a long time or whatever, but you should definitely know about Khan Academy. So the thing about Khan Academy is that they provide a wide variety of subjects, a wide variety of learning and a lot of different subjects for free. And I would say that most of the stuff that I've encountered there is like probably high school, college level stuff. But if you're looking to shift careers and you didn't learn math, for example, right? And you're trying to shift to a math-based or engineering career, you should definitely hit up here first, right? It's free, doesn't cost you money, and this is some good material, and they do a really good job of helping you learn on your own. So
what's their revenue stream? How do they make money?
I actually really haven't done a whole lot of research into it. I've heard about them multiple times, but I'm totally, dude. These guys are pretty awesome. They provide education for free. That's pretty sweet in a lot of ways, in our society, since most things cost money. But then I'm gonna give you a pay for one too. So there are a lot of pay for course things out there, and one that I didn't actually know about until recently is Udemy or whatever, which I think is basically, I think the idea, or Udemy or whatever, I think the idea is it's the end of Academy, except that it's you. Anyway, the point is, this is pay for. It's not too expensive, though, and you can learn I would say this is like a higher tier learning thing. So I've talked about like a couple places that you can learn to program and things, but this is pretty general. It does have some programming stuff on it, but it has some other general things on there too, and it's pretty sweet. I actually took a course this week, which is actually kind of cool. Because I don't do this very often, because I have a difficult time finding any sort of time for anything. But the point is that this is actually pretty cool too. And I'm bringing these two up, not necessarily because you should pick these two, but I'm bringing them up because there's a lot of resources online to learn about all sorts of things now. And you should definitely take advantage of that ecosystem that's growing. And these two things, I don't know how long they're going to stick around. They might be here in 10 years, who knows? They might be gone in a year. But you should definitely take advantage of all of these learning places. Great things. But and if you know of more, let me know, because I'm always trying to find more places to tell other people about, right, so that they can find things. So then for my second pick, I've had a buddy that's told me for a long time that I need a mechanical keyboard, and I'm like, why the hell do I care? I have a keyboard, it works, why should I care at all? And my keyboard now doesn't work. And so, you know, I needed a new keyboard, and, you know, with begrudging, listening to my friend who knows more about this stuff, I decided to go ahead and get a mechanical keyboard. And, I'm very happy that I did. I've had it for like a week now, and it's pretty awesome. So I guess there's a few things that I have to say here. One, their marketing stinks, because their marketing did not convince me to buy the keyboard. My friend convinced me to buy the keyboard. Because when you go look up mechanical keyboards, the first thing you're going to notice is that everyone's like, yeah, you need to know which kind of switch you want. Do you want the cherry kind? Do you want, I don't even remember all the kinds. It's like cherry MX blue and cherry MX brown and cherry MX black and red. And I'm just, and there's other like things that aren't cherry. And I'm like, what the heck? Like, what do I pick? Who cares? It totally seems like it's being marketed to elitist people. And maybe that's true. Maybe that's what it is being marketed to, but totally not selling correctly. But anyway, the point is keys are awesome to press. I get a lot. Anyway, the point is you get a lot of feedback when you press on the keys, which is, it depends on who you are, whether that matters or not. But the other thing that is really awesome is all the keys are above my keyboard. If I need to clean my keyboard, which you might have to do if you keep it for longer than a few years, you just pop off the caps, the keys themselves, and you just like wipe it down. It's that freaking easy. There's no like depressions or things. Like, it's pretty much impossible for you to clean your laptop keyboard, or if you clean, you know, some of the other keyboards you have. Anyway, easy to clean. Don't spray water on it. So that's been pretty awesome. They are more expensive, and perhaps that's why their marketing is not, you know, geared towards the average person. But it's pretty happy. It's got that kind of old clacky feel, right, that you used to have with keyboards, which is really nice and lets you type a whole lot faster, which may not matter for you, but it kind of does matter for me. And if you're a gamer, it matters for them too. So,
if you're a gamer, you should just have a 20 mouse, so.
A 20-button mouse, is that what you said? Dude, yeah. I don't do that, man. We talked about this earlier. Like, I do the vanilla mice. I like just a plain mouse.
I know. I was referencing that, but yes, we had the,
anyway.
That thing. Anyway,
those are my picks.
Good picks. So, as usual, I go for more of the non-tech picks, but I think access to education in an age where there's a deliberate attempt to make it more difficult is even more important. But because let's make it clear, the powers that be want to limit how much you know and how well you know it. So educate, take every opportunity to educate yourself, because that's the only way you can protect your liberty and your freedom. So but my picks, I tried to pick some that are political in nature. So I'm going to recommend two movies. One is Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. I realize that it's kind of a cliche in many ways, but I think it really does. It's that way for a reason, because it's one of the best movies I've ever seen that actually deals with why it's important to have something like a filibuster. Right. And the difference between self-interest and civic virtue from leaders, I think, and the difference between appearance and reality. I mean, I don't know. Have you seen this movie, John? Mr. Smith Goes to Washington?
I have not. No, sorry.
Yeah, that's why I'm recommending it. Yes, yes. It's
not one of my
favorite actors, Jimmy Stewart. But basically, I put a link to it in the show. But basically, it follows a idealistic senator. Or maybe he's a house. I think he's a senator. Anyway, it follows an idealistic congressman who's played by Jimmy Stewart, who goes to Washington to find out that things are a lot more corrupt, and he basically stands by his principles and wins one for the people. And you know, as much as you can say this never happens, it actually does happen, and it has happened in Congress a lot. So I think it's really important to kind of get a context of when they're talking about taking away some of these checks in Congress, just what that means. And I think Mr. Smith Goes to Washington can do that. And then, you know, I'm going to recommend a fantastic movie called Shishigura, which is based upon a Japanese play. And it's such a popular story that there are zillions of versions of it. I'm going to recommend the 1962 version, with Toshirô Mifune, because he's one of my favorite actors. But it is a fantastic movie about the dangers of bureaucracy, and what we would all like to do sometimes as a result of those dangers. And it is one of the first movies I had ever seen. I saw it in the Berkeley Film Archives, actually, when I was about 8 or 9 years old. And I went with my mother and three of my older brothers, who were all in their 20s and 30s. And it was the first time I ever remember seeing a movie and seeing grown men cry. And like, it is powerful and visually beautiful. It is just a fantastic, fantastic movie all the way around. And honestly, it is a revenge flick. I'll just say that. It does not have a happy ending, but I don't think great things necessarily need to have a happy ending to be profound and to make good points. So Shush and Gura, and a link is in the description below. And then on to something a little bit happier, I'm going to recommend one of my favorite TV series of all time, Boston Legal. I have no good rhyme or reason. I'd love to justify it, but the thing is, Jamie Spader and Captain Kirk, William Shatner, are fantastic in the series. It's got an ensemble cast. The writing is quirky and witty and funny. And it's just a fantastic show. It breaks my heart to this day that they ended it early, because it is one of those shows where it also breaks my heart. I cannot find it digitally. I own the DVDs, but it's one of those ones that it's just rewatchable. It's funny. It's relevant. It's got heart. It's just fantastic. It made me a huge Jamie Spader fan. And then I'm also going to recommend something that I forgot I was going to recommend, which was West Wing, which was absolutely, I mean, this is another one of those picks that I feel like is a little on the nose, because it's a cliche in a lot of ways, but it's a cliche for a reason. And even though it is a make-believe United States, and even though a lot of the things in it are false, I feel like it has a lot of lessons to teach us about cooperation and the conflict between self-interest and the state. And it's just a fantastic show for all of its seasons. It deals with transitions of power and all these things, and the role of the press secretary and the media. And it just, I think it gives a really great, you know, just a baseline. I mean, it's not factual or anything, but it gets you thinking about things that I think are important. And when thinking about politics, and it's on Netflix. So, you know, if you have Netflix, you can watch it all the season. It's really good. And I'll put a link in the description. John, have you ever seen The West Wing?
I've seen an episode. Dude, I feel like you're trying to call me out today.
No, I just want to make sure that I'm recommending things that maybe people other than myself haven't seen. Like,
yeah.
This show was so popular when I was a kid, like, it was like, it's like recommending Friends, right? Which, you know, maybe people haven't seen Friends either, because, you know, I'm old now. But I'm not calling you out as much as saying, is this something, am I recommending national parks? You know, I just got to be careful.
Oh, man. You went there.
So, and then finally, my last recommendation.
Parks, great recommendation. I would recommend him again.
So, you know, then you shouldn't be too. Then you should love Teddy Roosevelt. But anyway, and Obama. But
did I ever say I didn't like Teddy?
The last recommendation I'm going to make is a actual book series. By a guy named Patrick O'Brien. I think John at one point had recommended the movie, which I've never seen, Master and Commander, which is the first book of a series, I believe, of 24 books by Patrick O'Brien. At this point, it should be no surprise to anyone who's listened to our show that I love sea stories. A nuance to that, I adore Napoleonic sea stories, and this is definitely one of the best.
I don't know if I recommended, you know, but I do know that I said something about it today. So,
fair enough. Yes, you did say something about it today. And, but I will say this: I think the best military sea story series of all time is the Hornblower series by C.S. Forrester, which I did recommend. This is a close second. Very different. It's, I would say, where Hornblower is a romantic melodrama of the ascent of one commoner to a position of lordship, which, so it's a rags to riches story. The Patrick O'Brien series is a buddy cop series on the ocean. And it's got two protagonists that play off each other, you know, kind of like a Holmes and Moriarty, kind of like a Riggs and Murtaugh, you know, kind of just like, and if you love the buddy cop genre of two people, you know, the odd couple types, you know, this series of books is badass. Oh, and if you like badass sea battles in the Age of Sail, it's also awesome. Now, granted, both the Hornblower series and this series perpetuate that mythos of the British invincibility at sea, which, you know, there is some justification for that mythos. These series is definitely, like, you know, have no bones about saying, yeah, Britain rules the waves and we put the smackdown on everybody else, but they're just great, in my opinion, really good stories. So Bastion Commander by Patrick O'Brien, great series. He died when I was in high school, which is just really sad because I was on book, I think, 19 at the time. He died, and I think his last book was published after he died. Posthumously? Gosh, I cannot say it today. Yes, that's the word. It's just one of those series that as a high school kid, I read and loved, but most people read this series in their adulthood, and they love it too. So, highly recommend it.
Yeah, and the movie is good. There's a reason why I quoted it. You know, the movie is good and enjoyable. So,
yeah, but as you know, I've kind of
books are better. I get it. Movies. Books are better than movies. No, this is so true. Generally,
it depends.
Generally, so.
Almost every single time. But I mean, there are exceptions. I think that both Starship Troopers the book and Starship Troopers the movie are very good for very different reasons.
Yes, that's fair.
American Psycho the book and American Psycho the movie are both equally disturbing, but both equally well done. Hold on, what's another? You know, there has to be another movie book that I like. I'm sure there is.
You just can't think of it. It's all right.
I thought the Ender's Game movie was pretty good. Honestly,
I disagree with you so strongly on that. I did not like the movie.
Really?
Nah, why yeah. So you have to understand that at the end of the book series, at the end of Ender's Game, I was actually surprised. Right? Not totally surprised. It's not been the biggest surprise I've ever had, but there was twist to it. The movie, no twist at all. That bugged me a lot.
So that's interesting because, like, I don't recall the twist. Like, I felt like I knew it was real the whole time, right? Like, I felt that wasn't a surprise to me, but I felt like it was believable that like the kids would believe that it wasn't real, right?
Okay,
like, there was
fair.
Enough going on with the adults where I was like, something's not right here. I guess, in capturing the themes of the book and putting them into a movie narrative, I thought they did a really good job. And I thought that visually, like the way that they captured the command consoles, and I actually really, and especially considering that they weren't thinking that they were going to make the rest of the series. Like, I think, honestly, if they had decided to make Ender's Game and then go into the Shadow series, it would have been fantastic, like, more fantastic. I'm not saying it was I don't think the book is better than, or the movie is better than the book.
I did not feel the grip either of it. Like, I didn't feel like the intensity that the book has.
Well, the book is amazing. It is one of the best works of science fiction, I think, in the last half of the 20th century, easily. I think I can say that without being too far of a stretch. I think that so that is, and so I guess like the fact that I feel that the movie even got into the ballpark of what the book was trying to do.
You're basically setting the bar lower and saying the movie's good because it reached that lower bar, though.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways. I mean, so here's the thing. It should probably be documented at this point that I loathe the Peter Jackson Lord of the Ring movies. Absolutely loathe them. But, you know, the Is animated that films that came out absolutely fair. But and this is why. So the 70s cartoons, which are campy, horribly animated, and yeah, I actually don't have a problem with, because in a large part, the things that they did retain from the books rang true, where Peter Jackson just missed the entire point of the books completely. So it's possible for things to get the same truth that the books were going for in a completely different way, and therefore it makes it okay with me. Like, one of the biggest problems I had with the Harry Dresden TV series was that the book starts... Well, yeah, was the fact that it starts out with him sleeping with some chick. And you're like, that's not Harry Dresden. What the heck are you doing? This guy's not like some dude from a Dragonlance story. This is Dresden. What are you doing? Right? So if Harry Dresden isn't Harry Dresden, then the series isn't going to be the Dresden Files. Therefore, it's going to suck. And that's the problem with most movies to books. I mean, like, yeah, anyway, I think one of the coolest things about the Castlevania series, which I'm probably not going to recommend because it's more mature, like that one is, that's, it's pretty mature, but like, they captured Castlevania's essence really well, I feel.
I haven't watched that yet.
So, yeah. But it's good. It's good. I mean, I can tell you one movie that's absolutely superior to the book. The Princess Bride.
That's fair. Question in my mind. All right. Yep. Nope. I will not argue with that.
Outright. Yeah. Yeah. So.
But the movie wasn't trying to be the book. That's the thing. The movie is almost its own thing.
Yes, but that's what Starship Troopers the movie was too, right? Yes, like that, yes. There are those, like the movie. So it's funny because the book was kind of poking fun at fairy tales and fairy tale tropes in certain ways, whereas The Princess Bride, instead of just making fun of them, it redeemed those tropes. It's almost one of the reasons why I think that Man of La Mancha, the musical, is better than Cervantes' Don Quixote. And don't shoot me for that, because I recognize how amazing Don Quixote is. But Cervantes was sort of, you know, pointing out that knights were ridiculous through the whole point. I mean, that he was lampooning them. Whereas the musical asks the question is, well, even if they're silly, isn't what they're trying to do something that we should admire? Right? Like, the ideal is something that isn't silly. No matter how ridiculous they are, the ideal isn't, which is a beautiful and, I think, important message for people to have, right? I mean, still to this day, that line, it's not whether I win or lose, but only that I follow the quest, right? Like, it is so important to continue to try, in my mind. Anyway, love it. So sometimes, it's not
recommended, like, everything at this point.
I'm not recommending it. I'm just saying that in response to the book can never, or the movie can never live up to the book, that's not true. Yeah.
Okay.
Right? I just generally tend to assume that it's not going to happen. Therefore, if I really, really like something that's based upon a book I really like, I'm not going to go see it. And it's just like the Harry Potter movies. I think the first two movies, great. Everything after that, trash. Why? The first two movies were ports from the books. I loved it. The last ones, they tried to do their own thing, and they were just stupid. And then, of course, it doesn't help that I didn't like the last Harry Potter book, so I was obviously... So I didn't even see the last. I was like, if I didn't like the source content, and I didn't like the next couple movies, no way I'm going to like those last two movies. So not even going to bother watching them. So that's like, you know.
Fair enough.
Yeah, it's been too long since we've had an episode of things that we should really
get there again. Really, I know, man.
Okay. Because we did George R. R. Martin. I think Rawlings is up for.
I think so. Let's do it.
Maybe Peter Jackson needs to get in my scopes. I've been wanting to take a run at Peter Jackson for a while.
Shall we at least close out?
Yeah, let's close out. All right. Hey, thanks for sticking with us, guys, as we ramble on about the nerd things that we like and enjoy in life.
Yeah. All right. Have a good night. Take care.
Yep. Or see you guys next week.
Later.
Yeah. Later.
We would like to thank our listeners for joining us today. You can listen to today's episode and find out more about us, as well as find articles from our panelists and guests at battlecryforfreedom.com. We invite you to join in today's discussion by heading to the comments section on the episode page. You can also use our email addresses to contact us directly or to send feedback or topic suggestions. If you love listening to us, please leave us a review on iTunes or Google Play. We'd like to thank you again for listening, and we look forward to seeing you next week.
Show notes for this episode can be found at battlecryforfreedom.com/episodes/32.